طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it every week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. We begin this week with a short interview conducted by Mehdi Hassan on his new show on Peacock with Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen, who recently wrote a provocative piece in The New Yorker entitled In the Shadow of the Holocaust. Both Mehdi Hassan and Masha Gessen are facing criticism for their critical analysis both of Israel and the United States for their complicity in the genocide being conducted in Gaza. At the heart of Israel's defense of its occupation and siege of Gaza is the weaponization of the term anti-Semitic. Any criticism of Israel is identified as anti-Semitic, as well as any use of boycott of Israel language as a nonviolent strategy for resisting occupation and apartheid in historic Palestine. The name-calling is an attempt to divert criticism of Israel. Here is Masha Gessen on the Mehdi Hassan Show.
Russian-American writer Masha Gessen won a prominent award, the Hannah Arendt Prize, in Germany yesterday, but it followed a series of events that nearly derailed the entire ceremony. Multiple sponsors pulled out, the venue was moved, and attendance declined. Why? Because Gessen, a Jewish descendant of Holocaust survivors, was accused of anti-Semitism due to a recent piece they published on Israel, the Holocaust, and Gaza. I spoke with Masha Gessen, a staff writer for The New Yorker, earlier today. Masha Gessen, thanks for joining me on the show today, and congratulations on winning the Hannah Arendt Prize. I do believe, and I've seen the reporting, that the prize was, the ceremony was scaled down and delayed, and so I have to begin by asking, and sorry, I feel like a Fox host asking this question, but was there an attempt to cancel you, you a Jewish descendant of Holocaust survivors, by some in Germany this week, because of your views on Israel and Gaza? Is that what happened?
That is what happened. I share your dislike for the word cancel. But so let's say I wasn't canceled, but the prize ceremony was canceled. The discussion at the university that was supposed to follow the prize ceremony was canceled. Then the organizers of the prize, who are wonderful, hospitable people who really stood by me, they organized an alternative scale-down prize ceremony at the Institut Français in Bremen, and that was canceled. So in the end, instead of a large sort of banquet dinner, we had a dinner at a private house for 14 people to scale down to from about 400. And then literally a back alley prize ceremony. It was in a sort of semi-permanent community space heated by a pot-bellied stove. Wow. It was terrific and was... It was very much in the spirit of what my article was about.
So let's talk about your article that prompted the German criticisms and controversy in your New Yorker essay, In the Shadow of the Holocaust, which is phenomenal. I urge everyone to read it. You talk about Gaza in the 17 years up till now, under the siege, under the blockade, being, quote, a ghetto, not like the Jewish ghetto in Venice or an inner city ghetto in America, but like a Jewish ghetto in an Eastern European country occupied by Nazi Germany. You also say the Gaza ghetto right now is being liquidated. Can you just briefly unpack that pretty strong analogy for our viewers tonight?
Absolutely. That is very much the point of the essay to me, is that short passage that you just read out. And that's also the passage that caused all the controversy in Germany. For a long time, people in the human rights community and sort of in the media have used the analogy of an open air prison to describe Gaza. If you think about it for a minute, I have no idea what an open air prison is. I don't think it's a thing that exists. And the thing about metaphors is that they have to call up or analogies, they have to call up something that we can imagine. And when I thought about what Gaza really is, Gaza under siege, so Gaza before October 7th, it is most like a ghetto. There are significant differences, and I'm not saying that there aren't. But the closest analogy that we have to Gaza, which is an isolated, immiserated, hyper-densely populated space that is controlled by the people who built the fence, but isn't governed by them, but is actually governed by a force that is in many key ways enabled by the people who built the fence. So the reason that I think it's important to use the word ghetto is because it gives us language for what is happening now, which is that the ghetto is being liquidated. And the reason I think that's important is because after the Holocaust, humanity said, never again. Well, in order to make never again not an empty slogan, not a magic spell, but an actual political project, we have to have tools for recognizing when something like that is happening so that it actually can not happen again. And I think something like that is happening in Gaza, or at least I'm making the argument that there's good reason to think that something like that is happening in Gaza. And that poses the question to the world, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to make good on the promise of never again?
So, Masha, it's not just in Germany that people are getting all worked up. There is this frenzied, almost hysterical debate here in the US right now, especially in relation to college campuses, as to whether anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. The House recently passed a resolution declaring it is. And there's this IHRA anti-Semitism definition, which basically says comparing Israel to Nazi Germany in any way is anti-Semitic. Again, given you are the Jewish descendant of Holocaust survivors, what do you make of this use, some would say abuse, of anti-Semitism in the criticizing Israel context?
It scares me, because I know that anti-Semitism is real. And when people lump into the same pile things that are anti-Semitism, such as actual violent attacks, which have happened here in Germany, which have happened in the United States. I wrote about the Squirrel Hill attacks not that long ago. There is actual anti-Semitism, including, I believe, on college campuses. But when things that are not anti-Semitism, things that are legitimate political critiques of Israel, or even not legitimate political critiques, but not essentially anti-Semitic critiques of Zionism, they should not be lumped together with anti-Semitism. That actually puts us in more danger rather than protects us.
One last quick question, Masha. When you hear elected Republicans like Elise Stefanik pretending to care about Jewish Americans while endorsing an anti-Semitic great replacement theory, while supporting an anti-Semitic presidential candidate, what do you make of that, I don't know, cynical use of anti-Semitism to score political points?
Well, I see it as being connected to a worldwide trend. We have seen right-wingers in Germany, the AfD, right-wingers in Poland, who were fortunately just voted out of power, right-wingers in Russia and the Soviet Union. I'll call them right-wingers for simplicity's sake. And now in the United States, using this riding anti-Semitism like a political horse, because no decent human being, or no human being who doesn't want to be heavily criticized, can reject anything that is done in the name of fighting anti-Semitism.
Yes.
Even what's done in the fighting anti-Semitism is anti-Semitic, as I think Stefanik's use of anti-Semitism on college campuses is profoundly anti-Semitic. The trope that she is using in these hearings and her campaign to get rid of these university presidents,
yes,
is that the Jews control the money that goes to the universities, and so she just has to draw attention of the Jews so that they withdraw their billions. And you know what? It's happening.
That's a very good point, Masha Gessen. Sadly, we're out of time. Thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Appreciate your insights. Congratulations on your prize. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mandy.
That was Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen in conversation with Mehdi Hassan. And now on to our feature presentation, which today is an interview with Hanan Ashwari, longtime leader and often voice of the Palestine Liberation Organization, where she speaks out about what she calls the genocide in Gaza. Here is Hanan Ashwari.
Being in the Israeli-occupied West Bank is always a surreal experience. Israeli barrier walls have divided these Palestinian lands, allowing Jewish settlements to spring up on many of the hilltops. I'm heading to Ramallah to meet Palestinian politician and activist Hanan Ashrawi, her face synonymous with Palestinian negotiations for statehood. Yet, after nearly four decades of activism inside and out of government, Palestine, the state, seems distant, maybe impossible. I spoke to her about the war raging in Gaza and what it means for the future of Palestine.
Dr. Hanan Ashrawi, good to talk to you.
Thank you. Good to see you again.
How are you feeling about everything since October the 7th?
Well, it's a question of feeling. Sometimes we feel there is so much shock and pain and heartbreak that we can't feel anymore. It's very hard to think dispassionately and logically and so on when you see so much death and destruction and killing and deliberate and willful infliction of pain. It's just amazing. And the world is watching. They are not just war crimes and crimes against humanity, and these are deliberate massacres. And you're seeing whole families destroyed, bodies strewn everywhere. You're seeing everything that is basic to life, from hospitals to universities to schools to shopping centers. Everything is being destroyed. So I don't know. I don't know how to describe it, but I'm just feeling I'm heartbroken, I'm angry, I'm upset, and I think that they have violated the most basic norms of morality and human behavior, and they are inflicting so much pain, death, and destruction on a captive, helpless population. Mm-hmm. And it's deliberate, and it's out in the open, and the whole world is watching. So clearly now we are seeing the fault lines of north-south, the global south versus the north, east and west. We're seeing the colonial white supremacist mentality take over, the dehumanization and demonization of the Palestinians, and giving Israel free rein to wreak so much havoc and destruction. So this is what impunity breeds, when you can act outside the law and with full protection and inhumanity, you just become totally inhuman, basically. That's what Israel has become.
East Jerusalem and
the occupied West Bank, separate geographically and politically from Hamas and Gaza. To what extent has this Palestinian disunity over all these years contributed to the mess that we have now?
I don't think it's the disunity that contributed. In Palestine, yes, we have always had a pluralistic political system, and we've had the mainstream, and we've had oppositions, and we've had several parties from the extreme left to the... I don't want to call Hamas extreme right, but it's an ideological party. The problem is that this created, again... A rift has created a weakness within the Palestinian body politic. Whenever you have such a rift that is based on rivalry and exclusion rather than differences of opinion that can be accommodated democratically, that's when you weaken yourself. And this, Hamas was created in, 1987, 88 was their first statement, yes, March 88. And before that, there were several different parties and movements and factions and so on. But with Hamas, the separation, let's put it that way, in terms of politics, ideology, and then in terms of modus operandi, and then with the signing of the peace agreement, the differences became much more apparent. Even though Hamas did run for elections, as you know, and did win majority seats in 2005, but still... 2006, it created a gap, an opening through which anybody could enter by saying, we have nobody to talk to, who represents you, Hamas, you know, is a terrorist organization. It was labeled as such because it adopted the armed struggle approach. And so using that label and that refrain constantly, they tried to label all Palestinians, and particularly all Palestinians in Gaza, as terrorists. Mm. So this rift certainly weakened the Palestinians. And there were two different approaches to the political situation, whether through a negotiated settlement, which the PA and the PLO and the factions within it adopted, or the armed struggle, which Hamas used. So with two different approaches, it led to two different ways in which the people of the West Bank and of Gaza were treated. But the objective is the same. The objective is the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. The objective is the displacement of Palestinians and replacement of Palestine with greater Israel. And this is what's happening.
And one of the things that Netanyahu attempts to emphasize is that October the 7th happened completely unprovoked. Now, people yeah. such as yourself and others would say, well, there's a totting up over a long, long time of all these tensions, all these aggressions in the West Bank with the settlers, with a lot of these things set against the backdrop of occupation and siege. Mm-hmm. For a lot of the Israelis, I spoke with Ehud Olmert recently, and he even told me it wasn't so much that there was an attack on October the 7th, but it was the nature of the attack that was the switch for so many Israelis. Mm-hmm. It was the egregiousness of the intimacy of the violence and the killing of, yeah. of the people in the border communities. Address that for me. Was there something that made you squeamish about the attack?
There are several issues that are different in this. I mean, of course, the whole world saw how Israel bombed and shelled and killed Gaza in five instances, you know, where they killed thousands and thousands of Palestinians and demolished whole neighborhoods. And that wasn't seen as something horrific because that's from a distance. Yeah. That's not personal. I just push a button, I just do this and I can, you know, destroy your home and your neighborhood and your whole area and so on with no accountability whatsoever. So there was a modus operandi that was horrific. To me, it was horrific. You're allowed to kill from long distance. You're allowed to kill in an impersonal way. You're allowed to kill if you're anonymous, if you use high tech. Hmm? But should you react, should your victim react, then that's terrorism. There was this asymmetry, this lethal equation. All right. Now, For 16, 17 years, Gaza was a prison. Gaza was under siege. People had the minimal level of subsistence, of a normal life. And Israel did so deliberately. And every once in a while it shot and killed and maimed and injured and so on. So there was an ongoing deliberate torture of people in Gaza, imprisoned like that. The one surprise to the Israelis was the fact that they had become complacent in two ways. One, they had absolute faith in the army, the invincible army, and in their high-tech weaponry and walls and I don't know what, in order to think that they are able to withstand any kind of attack or approach, and that they can keep the Gazans within Gaza without any chance of their breaking free, breaking out. This is one. Two, there's a sense of racism there. It's this patronizing, condescending attitude. Oh, we know what the Palestinians are. We know what they're capable of. They can lob a few pipes here and there. It doesn't matter. But they didn't see. They were shocked at the fact that these militants broke out, that they had planned for 2 years since this fascist government in Israel took over, that they had succeeded in a military operation, and they took the battle to Israel. Because usually Israel takes the battle to other people's lands, whether it's even in Syria or in Lebanon, in the West Bank and Gaza. They attack. They're on other people's lands. They kill other people, and they can kill their civilians and so on with impunity. Look at what they do in the West Bank every day, every night. They enter homes, they destroy, they abduct, they kill, they torture. It's okay, even though it's intimate, the torture. And if you've seen the pictures of what they do. But to them, it's the element of surprise. And it's the loss of the invincibility. And the fact that they are untouchable in the sense that you cannot reach me. That I can do whatever I want. And I'm used to the fact that I can act with impunity and with no accountability. That's another shock. Three, there was something really horrific in the sense that they immediately came out with lies. They immediately came out with Photoshop pictures, for example, the burnt child or something, which was
but
later
not all of it was lies, though. I mean,
not all of it.
Some of these things
from
Qassam body cam,
yes,
cameras. There was some.
There were some
crimes
pictures.
That
yes,
committed.
Of course there were, because when you come out and you attack, it's not just the fighters, it's not just the militants who are out there. As you saw, lots of Gazans just came out because they saw that there's a break in the fence, that they can't do it. And they did come out. So, yes, there were horrific things that happened. But people didn't understand the context, that this is what has been happening to the Palestinians day in and day out for years since the creation of the State of Israel. And this is what reminded Palestinians and our parents' generation and so on of 1948, that the intimate massacres, the killing of innocent civilians, the total eradication and razing of 500 villages, the expulsion of 750,000, that this is how Israel was created. And now it is repeating that. There is a historical memory, there is a pain, and there is a current memory of being targeted, of being a sitting duck, being a victim all the time, and imprisoned, and beaten, and killed. So they came out. Some of them took revenge, yes. But what is different, and nobody, of course, approves of the killing of civilians. We don't need to prove our moral fiber, you know. But what bothers me is the fact that, as a result, Israel felt it had license, and it was encouraged and rewarded by the US, by the UK, by Germany, and so on, to, as a matter of policy, carry out this carnage, these massacres, this genocide. It's not a few people who walked away, who came out. It's not fighters who are not a disciplined army. It's the fact that this state, as a matter of policy and government, took a decision to to carry out genocide and is doing it.
You say genocide, so what's the end game then for Gaza? What do you think they want?
Well, Gaza is not separate. Look, from the beginning they wanted to empty out Gaza. They said so. He said, I want to turn Gaza into rubble, which he's proceeding to do. Then he said he wants to push them south, and they still are pushing them south. He wants to destroy and kill
Hamas. He is in Netanyahu.
Yeah, yeah. And his ilk and his group of fascist murderers, really. So, I mean, I think they had several targets, several objectives. And they sort of kill and proceed and let's see what we can do. They found out, I think, they cannot get rid of Hamas. It's ridiculous because if, so far they still don't know what Hamas is or who Hamas is. Whether we agree with it or disagree, you have to look at facts. Are you going to kill all the people who belong to Hamas or support Hamas? Are you going to kill the political, as they said, as well as the military wings, as well as their social systems and organizations and so on? What can you do? So they wanted to get rid of Hamas, eradicate Hamas. They cannot do it. They want to render Hamas unable to fight, destroy its military wing. If they're unable to find them till now, after more than 7 weeks, how are they going to find them? Without moving to the total razing and destruction of all of Gaza, all of the Strip. And they are doing it. So then they said they want to kick them out. The expulsion, the forced dispossession, uprooting and expulsion and displacement of Palestinians. Of course, the Palestinians aren't going to leave, even though 75% of the people of Gaza are already refugees since 48, when Israel was created and expelled them. The villages, the towns, they're looking out where their own villages and towns and so on. So there is a real determination. There's a collective historical trauma among the Palestinians. 1948 will not happen again. We will not be expelled. Right. We will not leave. And you hear them saying, we will die where we are, but we will not leave. And it's the same in the West Bank. So so the what next depends on how it ends as well. But one should understand that there are basic underlying principles that must be observed and respected. Palestinians have the right to be free, to live in dignity and sovereignty on their own land. We have the right to self-determination, to determine what our own system is. And we don't want to see any more. It's not just occupation. I mean, really, it's a post-colonial, neo-colonialism to the point where people feel free to reorganize our lives and our demography and see how to move us from one place to the other, expel us into Sinai, push us into the desert in Gaza, or expel us to the East Bank if you're in the West Bank and so on. So all these and increasing and intensifying violence and murder and destruction is not going to produce results. They haven't since 48, and they won't produce results. Maybe it's time for a mind shift.
One of the theories, you say there's time for a mind shift. One of the ideas is that the PA will retake control of the Gaza Strip in addition to the West Bank after the Israeli goal of eliminating or at least crippling Hamas is achieved. While we were setting up in your office, I noticed you had the recent book by the Palestinian-American historian Rashid Khalidi talks about the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. And I was reminded of an interview he did with Al Pais recently. Now, I know you're not directly, I'm just going to call it up on my phone, you're not directly involved with the PA anymore. You're out of that political picture right now. But something
I'm an independent. So
absolutely.
I mean,
when we think of Oslo, we think of the Madrid conference, we think of all the negotiations on behalf of the PLO and the Palestinian Authority. You're one of the faces that springs to mind, and you would accept that.
Of course, I worked hard.
Yeah, something very interesting that he said in response to the question from El Pais about, is the Palestinian National Authority a viable option in Gaza? And I know you suspect he's going to criticize the PA harshly here. He says, one of the great problems the Palestinians have is a lack of strategic thinking and young, innovative leadership. We have an old and corrupt leadership in Ramallah that is politically bankrupt. It has no ideas and continues to pursue a strategy that failed decades ago. It failed after the 93 Oslo Accords. It failed before the Second Intifada. They have empty minds, and most Palestinians hate them for being collaborators with Israel. They are not a viable alternative for the Palestinians. Israel wants the Palestinian National Authority, of course, because Israel and the United States created it. That's Rashid Khalidi.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, he's a friend of mine. We work together. It may be extreme, but in a sense, what he says is essentially true. Mm. That we do have a dysfunctional political system. It has been manipulated. Now, you want to talk about the system and the structure and the institutions or the individuals. They are, I think, two separate things.
Some good people in a bad system.
Or
the other way around.
I think
good structures but bad people.
We are able to create systems. We are able to legislate laws. We are able build institutions. The Palestinian people are highly educated and they're highly skilled. Mm. And they want to build themselves up internally. We just don't have a political class, a political elite, let's say, that can govern. The moment that can create a system of governance, the moment they took over, somehow the idea of ruling, of governing with a sense of appropriation, like they own the people and the land and the cause and the discourse and everything, and they stuck to their position. Yes, they are old. Nothing against being old. I'm old, but I left because when I resigned, I said we need young, fresh minds who know and who can reach the world and who understand the requirements of decent governance and so on. I left because I also knew there were all sorts of things wrong with the system in a variety of ways, including political decision-making. Mm-hmm. And because the agreements positioned them in a way as to protect the security of the Israelis, whether they're settlers or the army or whatever, without enabling them, without giving them any tools or accepting that they have the right to protect their own people. And this is a major factor for the loss of credibility and confidence and respect.
And is that why a lot of people support Hamas?
A lot of people, I mean, look, you have to be more ideological to support Hamas. The younger generation is not Islamist in a way. They are more, if you think about ideology, they are more secular, they are more progressive, they are more open-minded, they want to reach out and change. Support for Hamas came because Hamas was seen to do something about the occupation. The resistance itself as an idea is an attitude as well, that you are not a tool of the occupation, that you are not a subcontractor, as the PA is being called, of the occupation. And then in that sense, yes, people accept that kind of Hamas. But if we have elections now, you can never have elections under trauma. People are really traumatized now, whether in the West Bank or in Gaza. You have to stop the carnage. You have to stop all this before you start talking about elections. And I'm sure that the PLO factions will not win in any election. It will not get a majority. Mm. It's very clear. And I still believe that only the Palestinian people have the right to choose their own representatives and leadership, not as a hollow slogan the way Biden says it and others, but really in a way that empowers the Palestinians. Between Hamas and Fatah, this polarization, there are others now. And there's a rising younger generation who speaks a different language, who seeks other objectives, and who are not tainted by the mistakes and the corruption and the abuse of the past. So whether both sides, I mean, if you look at public opinion polls before, people did not have, there was no majority for Fatah or for Hamas among the Palestinians. But now because Hamas is targeted, people are rallying to protect Hamas and to not to in any way condemn it. But at the same time, once the dust settles and once people have the right to reflect, I'm sure they would want to have a leadership that would be an expression of their own aspirations and rights, and that would protect their aspirations and rights. Now, to say that the PA has to go to Gaza, I mean, look, there are PA people, of course, in Gaza. The PA pays the salaries of the doctors, of some security people, of teachers. They're not totally separate.
Yeah.
But at the same time, and I don't think that it can happen in a way that would render the PA an instrument of the occupation to protect Israel's security in Gaza. Yeah. They need to reestablish anyway, whether the PA as an institution, which is dispensable, I think, or whether the individual parties, the PLO and others, it needs to reestablish its own credibility. People need to have leadership that they trust, leadership that they respect, leadership that is an expression, as I said, of their own rights and aspirations. And this is what needs to be done. So we need to have more, I don't know, different political parties, organizations, groups that will, in general, generate an agenda, a political agenda.
And space for young people.
Of course, young people and women. Because I've worked in politics most of my life. I've been the exception or the small minority. But women make a difference in government, in governance, in positions of responsibility. They do. We have a different mindset when it comes to how to discharge our responsibilities. And, of course, young people have a fresh image. I have nothing against experience, provided you don't think you have a monopoly on power and resources and everything. But the young need to be able to find their own space, and they need to find expression in shaping their future.
Dr. Ashrawi, I have so much more to ask you, but we're out of time. So I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All the best to you. Take care.
You have been listening to Hanan Ashrawi, Palestine Liberation Organization leader and longtime voice for the Palestinian people. Sometimes we bog ourselves down in our attempts to define such words as anti-Semitism, apartheid, and genocide. We should not allow such sideshows to divert us from dealing with the larger controversies, occupation, and colonialism, but it is worth noting that Israeli Holocaust scholar Raz Siegel decries Israel's assault on Gaza as textbook genocide. Here he is with Amy Goodman on Democracy Now, making his case.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A textbook case of genocide. Israel has been explicit about what it's carrying out in Gaza. Why isn't the world listening? That's the headline of a new piece in Jewish Currents by our next guest, Raz Siegel. He's an Israeli historian, associate professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Stockton University, where he's also an endowed professor in the study of modern genocide. Raz Siegel joins us now from Philadelphia. Professor Siegel, welcome to Democracy Now! Lay out your case.
Thank you for having me. I think that indeed what we're seeing now in Gaza is a case of genocide. We have to understand that the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide from 1948 requires that we see special intent for genocide to happen. And to quote the convention, intent to destroy a group as defined as racial, ethnic, religious, or national, as such, that is collectively, not just individuals. And this intent, as we just heard, is on full display by Israeli politicians and army officers. Since 7th of October, we heard Israel's president. It's well known what Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said on 9th of October, declaring a complete siege on Gaza, cutting off water, food, fuel, stating that we're fighting human animals and we will react accordingly. accordingly. He also said that we will eliminate everything. We know that Israeli army spokesperson Daniel Hagari, for example, acknowledged one-tune destruction and said explicitly the emphasis is on damage and not on accuracy. So we're seeing this special intent on full display. And really, I have to say, if this is not special intent to commit genocide, I really don't know what is. So when we look at the actions taken, the dropping of thousands and thousands of bombs in a couple of days, including phosphorus bombs, as we heard, on one of the most densely populated areas around the world, together with these proclamations of intent, this indeed constitutes genocidal killing, which is the first act, according to the convention, of genocide. And Israel, I must say, is also perpetrating act number 2 and 3 that is causing serious bodily or mental harm and creating conditions designed to bring about the destruction of the group by cutting off water, food, supply of energy, bombing hospitals, ordering the fast evictions of hospitals, which the World Health Organization has declared to be, quote, a death sentence. So we're seeing the combination of genocidal acts with special intent. This is indeed a textbook case of genocide.
Can you talk about the displacement? Israel saying that the entire northern Gaza, now hundreds of thousands of people have complied, must move south. The northern part of Gaza is the most populated with Gaza City.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as is well known, this is an impossible order. It's impossible for specific groups of people in hospitals, people defined as disabled, elderly people, many Palestinians who refuse to leave their homes because of their histories and their memories of the Nakba. This is an impossible order. It's yet another indication of the intent to destroy, the intent to commit genocide. It's also worthwhile to emphasize Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. New term that he coined, complete siege. It seems like a completely new term that really takes the what was already a 17-year siege on Gaza, the longest in modern history, which is already a clear violation of international humanitarian law. It takes this siege and now turns it into a complete siege, which really signals the turn to this kind of genocidal destruction that we're seeing, including with this eviction order. It's also worthwhile to try to explain, I think, why Israel is so explicit in its declaration. We've heard Israel president talk about evil. We've also heard about Biden's use of the word evil. EU leaders describe the Hamas attack as evil. And it has to be said, the Hamas attack were clear war crimes. The mass murder of more than 1,000 Israeli civilians, a horrendous war crime that rightfully shocked many Israelis and many, many people around the world. But evil is not a term to describe them. Evil is a term to decontextualize. Evil is a term to demonize and to really enhance the widespread fantasies of Israelis today that they're fighting Nazis. Actually, former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said that directly in an interview yesterday. We are fighting Nazis. We see this in many, many other indications in Israeli society and politics today. And if we're fighting Nazis, then everything is permissible.
Professor no Siegel, law. I actually wanted to go to the former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who's currently in the Israeli army. This is from a few days ago, where he exploded at the Sky News anchor Kamali Melbourne during an interview Thursday when Melbourne pressed him on Israel's attacks on Palestinian civilians. This is a part of what he said.
What about those Palestinians in hospital who are on life support and babies and incubators whose life support and incubator will have to be turned off because the Israelis have cut the power to Gaza?
Are you seriously keep on asking me about Palestinian civilians? What's wrong with you? Have you not seen what happened? We're fighting Nazis. We don't target them. Now, the world can come and bring them anything they want. If you want to bring them electricity, I'm not going to feed electricity or water to my enemies. If anyone else wants, that's fine. We're not responsible for them.
This is the point.
But you
this
keep
is
on.
The point.
You, no, no, I want to tell you. No, listen. You listen to me right now. I've heard you enough.
No, I understand. We're trying to have a conversation here. Listen, this is my program. This is my show. And I am asking the questions. Exactly. You're raising your voice. And I've asked you. And let me finish. We've already distinguished between
you,
Hamas.
Mister. I want to tell you,
you're trying to speak over me.
We are not. Shame on you.
It's nothing about shame. We're trying to have a conversation about a very serious situation here. And you are refusing to address it.
So that is the former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett exploding at the Sky News anchor Kamali Melbourne. Professor Siegel, you're an Israeli historian. This is what you're talking about when he uses the Nazi analogy. And also when he says, are you seriously talking about Palestinian civilians? Your response?
That's exactly what we're. It's very important to understand that in this context, the idea of fighting Nazis, the idea of using Holocaust memory in this way. There's a broad context, a long history, of course, of this shameful use of Holocaust memory, which Israeli politicians have used to justify, rationalize, deny, distort, disavow mass violence against Palestinians. And it has allowed also a view to develop that sees Israel as somehow exceptional, providing it impunity. The truth, however, is that all perpetrators of genocide actually see their victims as dangerous, as vicious, as inhuman, right? That's how the Nazis saw the Jews, and that's how today Israelis see Palestinians. And that's why the lessons of the Holocaust actually, which were never meant to provide cover and rationalize state violence and genocide, but rather protect groups, especially stateless and defenseless groups under military occupation and siege from violent states. The lessons of the Holocaust are now very, very urgent. We need to center the voices of those facing state violence and genocide, and we need to move to prevention as fast as possible. In order to do that, we need to recognize what's going on around us, what's unfolding in front of our eyes, which is really a textbook case of genocide, with the rhetoric, with the actions, with everything involved.
Raz Siegel is Associate Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Stockton University and the Endowed Professor in the Study of Modern Genocide. He's an Israeli historian. His new article for Jewish Currents will link to A Textbook Case of Genocide. The subtitle, Israel's been explicit about what it's carrying out in Gaza. Why isn't the world listening?
And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time and on KKRN.org, where you can stream us live every Monday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. If you miss a broadcast or want to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to our archive on the internet. Search for truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and then click on This Week in Palestine Archive. It is all there. We thank you for joining us. And we hope you will be with us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.